My name's Russell. I'm an alcoholic.
Russell.
I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's good to be here. I figured, you know, I was looking at the calendar before I came down here, and I did sort of like 8, a little bit of 9, and you know, I guess I was going to do, although who knows with me as far as what step we're on, sort of 9. But I noticed that I'm going to the International. I don't know how many people are going to the International here at the end of the month. Well, Chris is. That's it, huh? Well. You got to try to get there if you can do it. I know it's a hassle. It's in San Antonio. It's absolutely incredible. I've been to a bunch of internationals in Montreal and I think in Seattle and San Diego. And they're wonderful. They only happen once, what, every 5 years? Very interesting what happens when they throw about 150,000 alcoholics in a town and addicts and Al-Anoners and all that sort of stuff. It's a wonderful experience just to go there. But I'm leaving on the 29th to go there. So we really have, I want to sort of finish this up before the 29th, so we have 3 more sessions. So this will be more like I think I'll do like 10, 11, and 12. And then you'll get somebody in here who actually knows what they're talking about. And, you know, that kind of thing. So in any event, it is good to be here. I'm going to read a few things from the book, the big book, and Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. I'm going to start by reading something from Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers that has nothing to do with anything. And the only reason I like reading this stuff is because, well, actually, everything has to do with everything. Everything has to do with everything, you know. You never know who you're talking to. You never know when you read stuff out of these books. You know, there are no coincidences, and then 1 week down the road, somebody calls you up and says, you know, you read that one thing out of the book, and you wouldn't believe what happened the next day. Everything's connected with everything else in this deal. So I'm going to read I'll just read 2 things out of Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. Now, the reason I like to read out of Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers is because it's a book that a lot of people don't read. They don't even know about. And it really is it really states in a straightforward way what was going on in Alcoholics Anonymous between like 1935 and 1950. And, you know, we are constantly reading in AA. You know, the fellowship is changing in a sense. I don't think the disease changes at all. But the fellowship is changing and our world changes and a lot of things happen in Alcoholics Anonymous and the way we look at things, the way we look at things in the world. But we are always reading the same thing. You know, thank God we have a book that really doesn't change. Of course, how we interpret the book may change. And we have a book that says this. We read it before every meeting. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. We read that before every meeting. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. But, you know, we hear that and we can almost memorize those words written in 1939. In 1939, a group of 100 alcoholics got together, and they had been doing something for the previous 4 years. Now, unless you were there, you don't know what they were doing. Now, you may think they were reading the big book, but of course, the big book wasn't in existence. So as we read this paragraph, the starting out paragraph, the most important paragraph, it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. The first thing we sort of think is, well, their path must be what we're doing in here right now. But they didn't have the big book. They didn't have the big book. They didn't have the 12 and 12. They didn't have most of the literature we have here. You know, it turns out they may have been doing something different. So since in AA we're supposed to be tolerant and open-minded, and they say, what do they say, the height of ignorance is to contempt prior to investigation, I always like to sort of mention something from our literature which talks a little bit about what they were doing prior to 1939, you know, to give you an idea of maybe how the meetings were operating prior to 1939. Now, it's possible that this may sort of tick some people off because it's a little bit more into the God thing, maybe a little bit more into the religious thing. You know, religion in AA, unfortunately, in the fellowship, not in the big book, has had a bad time of it. Even though in the big book, most of the people were religious, not only spiritual, but religious, They talked about joining churches and congregations, even though back in 1935 and 1939, Dr. Bob's real sponsors, the people, the spiritual sponsors, were clergymen, Sam Shoemaker, you know, and Ed Dowling and Father Ed Dowling and people like that. Even though he was just surrounded by religious stuff, religions had a pretty bad time of it in AA. Even though Bill Wilson, in the big book, says Abby Thatcher came with him with a simple religious idea. Religion wasn't a dirty word back then. In the year 2010, you know, you say the word religion and people come at, they're coming at you with pitchforks. Like it's some sort of anti-AA thing. When sometimes I sort of think they've sort of turned the book on its head. And so I like to read from a book that's seldom really read from, and that's Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. And so I'm just going to write. I picked the two parts out here. And this is from page 218. This is the first AA meeting, the topic of the first AA meeting. The first AA meeting that they ever had, what was the topic? Who chaired? Now, the not rumor has it, but our literature tells us the guy who chaired the first AA meeting was Dr. Bob. Okay? What do you think the topic was? I know some of you know this. The guys who know it, don't yell it out. You know, because most people don't know what the first topic was. There is no record of what happened at the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous except for a grapevine account years later noting that it was led by Dr. Bob. So I'll tell you this. So this is like little known factoids. You know, so one day when you're at a meeting, you know, you could say, well, you know what the first meeting was about. And you're not just giving your opinion. This is right out of the grapevine. There is no record of what happened at the first meeting except for a grapevine account years later noting that it was led by Dr. Bob, who put his foot on the rung of the dining room chair, identified himself as an alcoholic, and began reading the Sermon on the Mount. The first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous before the big book was Dr. Bob reading the book of Matthew in the Bible, chapters Matthew, and that would have been chapters 5, 6, and 7. That's the Sermon on the Mount in the book of Matthew. Later on in our literature, it says the following. This is on page 227 of our literature, conference approved. The widow of an old-timer remembered Dr. Bob standing up at a meeting with the good book under his arm. That's the Bible. And recalled that he used to say, the answers were there if you looked for them. Because people back in Old Testament were just like the people of this century and had the same problems. And if he were here now, Dr. Bob might say the same thing about early AAs. That they were just like the members today and had the same problems. Dr. Bob donated that Bible to the King's School Group, where it still rests on the podium at each meeting. Inside is an inscription, quote, it is the hope of the King's School Group, whose sobriety that this is, that this book may never cease to be a source of wisdom, gratitude, humility, and guidance, as when fulfilled in the life of the Master. It is signed Dr. Bob Smith. An early Chicago member wrote that they usually resorted to such quaint evasions as the fellow upstairs in order not to frighten or antagonize the agnostics who were coming to the program. But Dr. Bob was the first group leader I heard refer simply and without ostentation to God. He cited the Sermon on the Mount as containing the underlying spiritual philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous. So just a little something, because, you know, sometimes I think about, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, a Jewish kid from New York, and I the last thing I was going to get involved in was reading the Bible and or get involved in any religious stuff, and I was attracted to You know, it says, what does it say? If you want what we have, if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And one of the things that'll save your ass in Alcoholics Anonymous, even without you noticing it, is no matter how much you think you know more than anybody else, no matter how bright you think you are, no matter what a smart ass you are, how sarcastic you are, or how much or how willful you are, one thing that'll save your ass is if you fall in love with an older member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, that will just beat you up. I mean, that's got to be the worst thing that could happen to you in Alcoholics Anonymous, being hip, slick, and cool, and really liking an older guy or gal in Alcoholics Anonymous who's got their shit together. Because it sort of like befuddles you. You want to hang around them. You're hip, slick, and cool. You know more than anybody else. You're smarter than anybody else. But you somehow are attracted to this person. So this concept of if you want what we have, having some sort of group of people or a person that you really want what they have, even though you may not understand what they have, and you're willing to do anything, possibly even doing stuff that you don't want to do. Can you imagine that? Doing stuff you don't want to do. Maybe sacrificing time that you would spend at the ball game or out of clubbing or something like that to be around them in some Denny somewhere. Maybe even getting to the point that you hang around these guys and they hand you a book like Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. And they say, why don't you read that, buddy? Or maybe you're hanging around. Or maybe the night that Joe Snyder said to me, have you ever read the Bible? And I said, no, I don't read the Bible. And he handed me the book by Emmett Fox, Sermon on the Mount. He says, why don't you read that? You know, when old timers and people that you care about and you want to be like and you want what they have start handing you books and handing you stuff, and you find yourself reading this stuff, and it changes you. You know, I heard a guy once say, not an Alcoholics Anonymous, the type of man or woman you'll be will depend upon the people you hang out with and you're hanging out with for the last 5 years or the next 5 years and the books you read. And the truth of the matter is, let's face it, the books you read really depends upon the people you hang out with. And so the fact is, I was, I don't know whether it's fortunate enough or I wanted this thing so badly, I hung around with these guys. They'd insult me. Well, it didn't take much to insult me, you know. It really didn't, because I was touchy. I didn't think I was touchy. I thought I was sensitive. I told my sponsor, I said, I'm sensitive. He said, Russell, he said, great artists are sensitive. You're touchy. You know? I had a lot of great ideas that were all crap, you know, and they didn't, and they were always, you know, I think that's what old timers do as a hobby. They just insult newcomers, and they weren't scared of hurting my feelings, and yet I kept on hanging around with these guys, you know, and they kept on telling me things. I kept on coming back. I kept on hanging around with them. Somehow I knew they had the secret. They had the secret. The secret wasn't out there. The secret was in here, and I found myself reading this stuff. And so here's what I think. You know, I could sit in here and pontificate about the ninth step and the tenth step or whatever step we're talking about. But here's the way I see this thing. And I could be wrong about this. I mean, I'm wrong all the time. I see that there's a possibility that when I'm speaking to a group of people, let's say whatever there is in here, 100 people, 150 people, I'm talking to a group of people, that there's a possibility that there are people in here that are not sponsored at all. Or there are people in here that are maybe sponsored, but they don't talk to their sponsor, hang out with their sponsor. Or there are people here that are even sponsored where, for no reason, but it just is that their sponsor isn't steeped in the background of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I think it's a great service. I think it's some sort of service I do. This may be the only meeting. Hey, the way AA goes these days, this may be the only time or shot you have in the next year or 2 years for you to even hear the book, Sermon on the Mount, or the book, Dr. Bob of the Good Old Timers, mentioned. And so I think it's not such a bad deal, you know, as I'm getting up here. If anybody even thinks that they may want just a little bit of what I have or what I'm talking about, to at least remember. You never know. Some guy may come up to me 10 years from now. He says, "You won't believe this, but I was at a step meeting you went to, and I don't remember a lot of things you said, but I remember you mentioned this book, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. You know what I mean? And I read it, and it changed my life. You know, so I like to, that's why I like to read this literature, because I believe, like they say, about the word does not come back void. that if there's somebody in here who wants this thing, that even if you just, you don't have to spend 2 hours talking, you just read a little bit of it, and they'll remember it. They may not remember it now, maybe a week or 2 weeks from now, or a month from now, or they may be in an AA room, and they may see the book in front of them, they may just pick it up and start reading it. So that's why I like to get into that stuff. I was, they say men and women drink, this is the big book, because they like the effect produced by alcohol. You remember when you used to drink? We do have some drinkers in here, don't we? I'm not like the only one, right? That'd be a scary thought. Men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. This is what they say. They say alcoholics are restless, irritable, and discontented. That's the nature. That's the way we are sober. Restless, irritable, and discontented. Makes it exciting to know that I'm about to go to San Antonio where we're going to get about 150,000 of us. 150,000 of us together in one place at one time, you know? We're restless, irritable, and discontented. Unless we can experience the ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinking is not the problem. Drinking for an alcoholic is the solution to the problem. The problem, what alcoholism is what you feel when you're not drinking. You understand? You get that? Alcoholism is what you feel when you're not drinking. Whether it's like a Valium or a prescription drug or whatever it is, alcohol is used to cure alcoholism. Now, of course, we don't know that because by the time we get here, the addiction to alcohol is so great, we start getting arrested for DUI, terrible things start happening to us, the wheels start falling off. So it sure looks to us like the problem is alcohol. And if we just stopped drinking alcohol, everything would be okay. And the truth of the matter is once we start drinking alcohol, a lot of problems associated with the consequences of drinking alcohol clear up. We all of a sudden have money on the dresser. We stop getting arrested for DUI. A lot of problems that happen as a result of getting fired because of drinking clear up. But all the other stuff that is a little subtle, more subtle, that has been busting up our relationship, busting up our marriages, you know, making us feel crap, all of a sudden start coming up over a period of time. Because now we're not drinking anymore. And sometimes it takes years in the program to really actually see the nature of what alcoholism is, to see the picture of what it looks like. You may not understand what it looks like. You may have to see a lot of people. One of the ways we see it is we see people talk from the podium. Guy will talk from the podium and he says, man, that's like me, that's like me. We may not see it in ourselves. We'll see it in, hey, that's just like me. Maybe we'll be at a meeting. Hey, listen, you learn stuff. Man, I'll tell you, AA is like a giant toolbox. There's a wrench to put every nut that walks through the door. You know, you do learn a great deal from listening to old-timers and people that have a lot of good things to say. But I learn a lot from the crazies. Because I am a crazy. And I was a crazy, and I could be a crazy again. How many times have I been in a meeting listening to some guy go off, alcoholically, go crazy, get mad, go nuts, say crazy, stupid, self-centered things, and has it clicked in my mind, I'll say something like this: that guy is crazy. Or you say something like this, alcoholics say things like this: whoa, he's alcoholic. That's, you know, he's really alcoholic. I don't believe this crap where they say there is no alcoholic personality. I'm telling you something. I can just sit here and I hear stuff at AA meetings that I only hear at AA meetings and that is so alcoholic and I can't even explain it, but you know it when you hear it. You know what I mean? Some guy says stuff, you know, and you say, man, is that alcoholic? But even being able to see that that's alcoholic allows me to see what the disease looks like. And how many times have I heard somebody go alcoholic at an AA meeting or look at something, you know how we look at things, skewed backwards? We look at things upside down. People are dying. And we talk about how it's affecting us. You know what I mean? A guy could be dying of cancer next to us and we're talking about how it made me really feel down. And you say, the guy's dying. It's not happening to you. You know, I mean, we're so, you say, man, the guy is like totally into it. He's, the guy can't get out of his own brain. He doesn't get it. And then what happens? A little voice comes in and says, man, all of a sudden, I'm just like that. I'm just like that. Now, if I went up to you in your face and I said, you know, this is the way you are. Let me tell you how you are. You're like this. Your defenses would go up. You'd say, take your own inventory. Who the hell you think you're talking about? You're full of crap. I'm not like that at all. You see, because if we're approached in a frontal attack, we immediately put our hands up and say, that's a bunch of bullshit. But if we're not being attacked, and it comes at us sideways, where we're watching somebody else and how goofy they are and how crazy they are, then all of a sudden a little voice comes in. If we have a constitutional ability to be honest with ourselves, the voice says, man, you're just like that. And all of a sudden it like grabs us and we see the light. It's incredible, this disease. And we learn stuff. This, man, you know you can't learn this stuff at the first day. How could you learn everything or see everything you see or experience everything you experience to learn about yourself? It says, unless and until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences, his sobriety be precarious, of true happiness he'll find none at all. How can you experience the full breadth in technicolor of your alcoholism at one meeting or two meetings? It takes 10 years of meetings to experience that stuff. You know, it's just unbelievable the stuff you can experience if you just keep on going. The pain, the suffering you have to go through, everything you go through or have gone through or happens to you is absolutely necessary to fill in the colors of that picture to see what's really going on in your life. You need every self-centered, selfish, self-pitying thought, every fear, every anxiety, you need the whole deal in order to somehow get you at the end. I mean, I think as T.S. Eliot said, it said, we have not ceased our exploration, and when we finally cease, we will come to the end of our journeys, to the place where we began, having known the place for the first time. And all of a sudden, one day, you're 29 years sober, 20 years sober, and you're still the same person. You haven't changed. You're in the same body, the same deal, whatever it is. And it's just you see things completely differently. And nobody has changed, and nothing has changed, except everything's changed. It's all about doing this stuff. I had something happen last week. I can't remember exactly what it was, but in any event, I experienced anxiety. Of course, when you first experience anxiety, you're not sure what it is. You just feel bad, and then after about 10 or 15 minutes, I realized I said I was anxious. And I was anxious for about an hour and about something. And I was going over, it was almost like, and then I realized, and then it went away and whatever, it's gone. But I remember thinking, and I didn't like it. Has anybody here ever been anxious, suffered from anxiety? It's crappy, you know? I mean, really, it's horrible. It's horrible to be anxious. That's terrible. And you know what I realized when I experienced it? It was actually a gift that I experienced. It was a great gift. I don't like it when it happens. But it's good. It's actually a good thing that I can still experience that. And believe me, I'm not saying, gee, look at me, I'm perfect. I'm just saying things have changed with me. Because one of the things I was thinking of, as I remembered, I said, it was a horrible deal. I hated it. I said, man, I don't like this. And then I said, Russell, this is the way it used to be with you all the time. I don't know if that makes any sense. It may not make any sense. Well, if you experience it all the time, you'll be saying, well, of course, that's the way it is. But my life, I never realized this. But my life was continuing anxiety with no relief all the time. Every once in a while I'd go to a meeting or I'd be with my sponsor or something would happen, and somewhere during the meeting at some point in time I would stop thinking about myself, I would start concentrating on the speaker, and I would get relief for a nanosecond. You know what I mean? And that was like a great meeting. I would somehow get involved with the speaker or somehow get involved with my sponsor. I'd be drinking coffee, and for a half an hour, I wouldn't think about myself, or I would help somebody out for half an hour, and that was good for a week, talking about how great I felt. But the truth of the matter is, my whole life was voices in my mind saying, what about this, what about this, this is going to happen, why did I do this, what? A million voices, a thousand times about a gazillion different things, what happened to me last week, last year, what's going to happen to me tomorrow, all bad things about myself and other people. Just horrible. And that was on a good day, and I call that good sobriety. And I thought my sobriety was good. I thought it was, you know, up until I was had 9 or 10 years, I thought that's the way it was. All the time, going from crisis to crisis, from worry to worry, from fear to fear. Men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. You think you stop drinking and that craziness goes away like that? I don't think so. All you have to do is hang around a few AA meetings and listen to some of the speakers and what people are talking about in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And then somewhere in the book it says, selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the root of our trouble. It doesn't say alcohol, it says selfishness and self-centeredness. Driven by selfishness and self-centeredness. This is what it says about you guys. This is what it says about me. That is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms. 100 forms. That means it comes in more than one form. You know, you say things like, well, I was scared or I was anxious. That covers two. There's like 98 left that you haven't even recognized. You know, when you're uncomfortable, when you're restless, when something's going on, you're saying, what's this? That's one of the 98. You just haven't put a name on it yet. You know, when you're 15 years sober, you'll put a name on that one. You'll recognize what it is. It might take you 5, 10 years to just see that deal. Right now, saying, I feel crappy is good enough. You just don't know where it's coming from. That is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics, above everything, above everything. This is what we're here for. We alcoholics must get rid of self. Must get rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. It doesn't even like bruise us. You know, it kills us. Then it says, God makes that possible. That's the statement. God, that was written by one of those guys that was carrying about that Bible around. They're saying all that stuff. That was talking, you know, it says, God, that's our program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why we have a third step. That's why we have God all things. It says, God makes that possible. God gives you a repeat. God will get rid of that craziness. God will rip that craziness right out of you. So just remember that next time you hear somebody say, I don't like people talking about God in Alcoholics Anonymous. They just don't want you to get the answer. God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore. You know, listen, it sounds terrible. It sounds like you're against motherhood to say, just do the next right thing. But the truth is, just do the next right thing may sound good. It may be a consequence of working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, but the reason, if you read chapter of the Gnostics, the reason why what we ultimately come to realize is that we're powerless to do the next right thing. We can't even manage our own lives. If we could manage our own lives and we could do the next right thing by ourselves, that's what our problem is, it says in chapter of the Gnostics. It says lack of power, that was our dilemma. So we had to find a power. Our problem was we don't have the power to do the next right thing. If we do the next right thing, it's generally by accident. We come in here and we associate with people that have the power. We listen to people that have the power. We start developing faith. We start developing relationships with God and with other people and people of faith. We start feeling better about ourselves. We start being transformed. We start doing the next right thing. And we think We have the power to do the next right thing. Well, watch what happens to somebody as long as soon as he cuts his attendance at AA meetings and cuts his prayer and cuts his inventory and cuts his faith in God and walks out there and just does the next right thing and see how that works after that. If we're doing the next right thing over a period of time relentlessly, it's probably because we're developing our faith and our relationship with God, which is what the 11th step is all about. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions of the law, but we could not live up to them, even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying our own power. I had a conversation with somebody, and you know, it sounds like this is what kills people. We really want to believe, and I'm not putting down treatment centers, that the answer to our problem is another treatment center. It's very hard to understand the concept of powerlessness. A guy will say something like this to me. This is how badly we want to avoid God. This is how badly we want to play God. This is an alcoholic playing God. He doesn't realize he's playing God. He says something like this. I'm really going to try to do better this time. I'm going to try to do this differently. I'm going to try not to get mad. I'm going to try not to hurt. I'm going to try not to. This is, you know, doesn't that sound good? I'm going to try not to. It sounds good. Have you ever tried to live life well on your own power? Have you ever said, I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm going to swear off. Or I'm not going to do this. How's that worked out for you? You wouldn't be here right now if it wasn't that. It's hard to grasp the concept of what they're talking about. They may say, we admit we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives were unmanageable. We admit that we cannot manage our own lives, that no human power could, only God could and would. It's hard to understand that the only way we can ever get to the point where we can manage this thing is if we throw ourselves entirely upon God and look to Him and to just give up and stop trying to play God ourselves like we have the power to do it. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying our own power. We had to have God's help. This is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. We play God in all sorts of things. We don't even realize we're playing God. We just say stuff and do stuff and try stuff that sounds good because we set these goals. I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that and I'm going to try to do this and I'm going to try to do that. And it's all good stuff. And then you say, well, I know you're going to try all that stuff. How about praying? I'm going to pray, but here's what I'm going to do. Here's my game plan. We're so busy trying to do for us what God is going to do for us. You know, thinking that we can handle it, we miss the whole deal. So I'm with my son, Andrew. I got divorced when I told this story last week. I'm going to tell it again, and I'm going to try to link this into something. When I got divorced, I'm working this out. I think it had something to do with booze. My wife said, "You come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you." I came home drunk, and she kicked me out of the house. That's the way it happened. She says, "You come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you." I came home drunk, and that was the end of a 5-year marriage. Lost my house, my wife, and lost my at that time 3 or 4 year old son. Got kicked out of the house. Of course, if you would have asked me at the time, why am I getting divorced? I would have told you that she didn't understand me. You know, she didn't appreciate me. She was trying to change me. The last thing I would have thought of is it had anything to do with alcohol. And I was driving, you know, 3 or 4 years later, I was driving 6 months sober. I was driving from Palm Beach with my sponsor. We were talking about getting divorced, and he told me how he got divorced, which was basically the same way. We all get divorced the same way. You know, you come home drunk one more time, they kick us out. And I said, boy, that's what happened to me. And I realized that not only did it have something to do with my divorce, My whole divorce, it was all about alcohol. She didn't say, if you don't start showing more attention to me, if you're not, she says, you come home drunk one more time and leave. And I came home drunk and that was the end of my marriage. And so one of the things that happens when you get a divorce is you get visitation rights. So I had visitation rights with my son, who's now like 32 and wonderful, wonderful kid. I have good relationships with all my children. I have 4 children now that I've raised. But I had this visitation, and he was, I don't know, about 6, 7, 8, 9 years. I'm not sure exactly how old he was. And I was scheduled to take him to the zoo on a Saturday morning. I had visitation rights, and I had gone out that Friday night with a gal named Sally. And Saturday morning came, and it was 10 o'clock in the morning. I got a call from Sally. I was on my way to pick my son up, take him to the zoo. And I got a call from Sally, and she said, hey, the girls are going out on the boat. Would you like to come along? So I want you to imagine, there I'm sitting there, and I'm going to go to pick up my son, you know, to take him to the zoo to see some wildebeest or something. I don't know. And here's this gal who's on the phone with me saying, we're going off with the other gals on the boat. Would you like to come along? I'm like sitting there. I'm like torn for 30 seconds, and then it's anchors away. I left. I didn't even call up my son. He was just sitting there waiting for his father to show up. I didn't show up. You know, I just left my son there waiting. And, you know, I'm saying to myself, and this is how alcoholics think. You know, I'd like to be able to say alcohol made me do these things. I was cold stone sober when I made that. When I made that decision to go out with Sally instead of my son, I wasn't drunk. You know, I'd love to say alcohol maybe. Most of the times I hurt people and made excuses and lied and schemed and did hypocritical things, I was cold stone sober. You know, the only thing alcohol allowed me to do is live with my sorry ass self, you know, while I was doing it. I probably would have blown my brains out if it wasn't for alcohol, thinking how crappy I was. Because of the voices that you have. You know the voices, you're a piece of crap, you're an idiot. You can drink those things away for a while. So I went out on the boat and I'm thinking things like, this is the way alcoholics think. My son will be happier. He wouldn't be happy being with, he'll be happier with his mother. He'll be better off without me going there. But you know, deep down where my alcoholism lives, you know, there's a little voice, I think it's like a little whiteboard there, you know, where every time I did something bad, it puts like a black mark there. And there were thousands of black marks there. And you know something? I could dress up real nice. I could put on a nice suit. I could put on a nice shirt. And I could put on a nice tie. And I could put on a nice show. You know, but the truth of the matter is I was a bum in a three-piece suit, hurting people and ripping out their hearts and being irresponsible. And the consequences of living life as a bum and knowing you're a bum is no matter how much money you have and how good you look and how much weight you lose, you just can't get rid of that voice telling you you're a piece of shit. That you just can't get rid of that voice. Every once in a while, you're just sort of, it affects everything. It affects who you hang out with. It affects how you talk to people. It affects when somebody says something to you, how you take it, whether it's personal. It affects what you think about yourself. It affects your self-esteem. Because the truth of the matter is, no matter what other people think about you, deep down inside, you know what a piece of crap you are. And your reputation with yourself really dictates how you live in this world. And it has a lot to do with being restless, irritable, and discontented. So that son of mine, I got sober. And about 7 years later, or whatever it is, after I got sober, he's riding with me one day in a car. He stayed over at my house, and I guess he was around 10, 11 years old. I'm not sure exactly, maybe 12 or 13. It might have been even later than that. I don't know how much time I had, maybe 6, 7, 8, 9 years sobriety, whatever it was. And I went to my bank to cash a check. And there was a drive-in. It was like a Saturday morning, but they had a drive-in that was open. And there were these two lanes that were open that you could stand in the drive-in. And they had cars. They must have had 10 cars in each lane. And I had a check. And there was this one lane that had only one car in it. But above that lane, it had a sign. And the sign said, commercial. Commercial. Commercial accounts or commercial. So I'm thinking to myself, you know, I'm a lawyer, I have a law firm. I say, you know, I have a commercial account. I have a commercial account. I have my law firm's account with this. You know, I'm like a commercial guy. You know what I mean? I mean, all I see above that thing is, Russell, this is your lane. And this is the lane. This lane you're in right now is the lane for people that don't have commercial accounts. Russell's lane, other people's lane. So I whip out of that lane, and I get behind the car in the other lane, because I'm special. And And I come up to the gal, and my son's sitting next to me. This is the 10-year-old. The guy's sat waiting for me, you know, to go to the zoo that I disappointed. He's sitting next to me, and I pull up, and there's this gal who's the teller there who, I mean, I'll tell you, if she was 18, she was just 18. If she was, I think she was like 12. She looked 12 to me, I'll tell you what. So I handed her my check to cash, and she looks at me, and she says, I mean, all she has to do is cash it, right? What's the big, all she has to do is cash it. And she says, I'm sorry, sir, this is for commercial accounts only. Now, you got to understand, I've already gotten out of the line. You know what I mean? So that would mean I have to go all the way around. And I said, wait a second. I said, listen to me. I said, I have a commercial account. I said, I'm a lawyer. I have my law firm's account with this bank. I'm a commercial guy. I have a commercial account. I have a commercial account here. You know what I mean? And she says, I mean, I don't know what was wrong with this woman. I have no idea. I have no idea what she was on, what kind of drugs she was on, how she could be so stupid or audacious. But she looked at me as if I, you know, I'm sure this would have impressed anybody. And she looked at me without flinching. She says, I'm sorry, it's for commercial transactions only. And I said, didn't you understand what I'm saying? I have a commercial account. I'm a lawyer. I have a attorney. She says, it's for commercial transactions only. And at which point I said, what's your name? What's your name? And I started writing it down and whatever. She gave me her name, you know, Rachel, whatever it is. Like, she needs this out. Just another out. Hey, listen. Just an alky going through a young girl's life. Just making her day special. You know what I mean? Just making her day special. Just another alky beating up on a 16-year-old kid. Just ripping out her heart, making her day special. Just another alky with 7 years sobriety. You know, fixing to get money so we can go to an AA meeting and tell people how wonderful he is. You know what I mean? And ain't it great to be sober? Just an alky going through who didn't want to wait online, you know, and, you know, what's your name? You know, who's your supervisor? Who's the president of the bank? Whatever the heck I said. And she gave me all that information, and she didn't even flinch. I figured, she said, okay, I'll cash. She says, sorry, we can't do it. And so I just sped on off. The hell with it. I went over to Publix. I cashed the check at Publix, and I started driving back. You know, now my son is witnessing this incredibly wonderful behavior. Has anybody ever done something similar to that? You know, if you're an alcoholic, I'm going to tell you something. You do that, it does not make you feel good. You get that, you know, that anxiety thing? There's an after effect. There's a half-life from that. There's a thing that sort of follows you along that really screws you up. And I recognized what was going on with me. I mean, I don't know how regular people feel. Regular people probably don't even do that crap. It takes an alcoholic to do that crap, but, you know, and I just couldn't. And I was in, and I want to tell you something. This wasn't done for my son. It was almost like he wasn't even there, because, you know, when you're an alcoholic and you're into your brain, there could be thermonuclear war going on outside. You're just into the gal. She said this, and I said that, and I said that, and she said that. I'm going over. And I whipped around and went back to the bank. I waited online behind the commercial vehicle. And I got back to the thing again. And I said, and I got up, and there was the same 18, 16, whatever, year old girl. She looked at me, he says, you remember me? When he says, yes. He says, I just want to tell you that I apologize. I was wrong, and you were right. And I'm sorry I said what I said to you. Okay, and I hope you know, well, something like that. And I'm very sorry I said what I said. I apologize to you. And then I drove off. And if you've ever done something like that before, you understand that whatever feeling you have of restlessness really evaporates like that. It's like it never happened. As a matter of fact, you feel better than you felt before you even did that. Your self-esteem for yourself, it's like somebody wiped out all those black marks, you know, and instead of saying things like, you're an asshole, you're an idiot, you start hearing voices like, you know, you're all right. You're a good guy. So I drove home, and I get out of my car, and we go into the house. You know, and I mean, it was just something that happened. I went to the house, whatever, I got the milk, whatever we were supposed to get. And I'm in my room, and I hear from the other end of the house my 10 or 11-year-old son excited, saying, "And Mom, you wouldn't believe." And then he went back to the thing, and he said this, and he told the girl that, and he said to the girl, says, "Listen to me, you know, there are people watching you. There are people watching you." You know, this sort of everyday experience of mine, this sort of 10th step, when you're wrong, whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the problem, there's something wrong with you, continue to take personal inventory. When you're wrong, promptly admit it and make the amends. This sort of stuff that we sort of do because this is the way we have to live our lives and stuff like that. We don't even think about it because we have to do it and it's tough. People are watching you. They're watching how you behave. My son was watching me. My son was witnessing this whole. I wasn't doing it because I didn't even know he was there. I was so involved in me. You know what I mean? I was just doing what we do. And he was like flabbergasted and amazed. I have a decent relationship with my son today. I mean, it could be better, of course. You know, I went through a divorce with his mother and everything. And when I remember the way he talked about. I haven't spoken about this in a long time. I'll bet if I spoke to him about it today, he'd remember it. And I can't help but believe part of the way he feels about me today, and maybe part of the way he feels about himself, and about your parents, the way you talk about your parents and things like that. I don't know what it is. I think it's possible that men and women get a lot of their self-esteem and how they feel about themselves by how they look at their parents. God knows, I've seen enough alcoholics, men and women, you know, who feel crappy about themselves and have all sorts of interpersonal problems, somehow during the same conversations talk about their home life and what it was like with their mother and father. So there's got to be some sort of connection there. You know what I mean? If you admired your father, you admired your mother, it's something to do with how you feel about yourself. I know I came from an alcoholic home when my mother was a drunk, and I was ashamed to bring people home because she'd be lying on the outside on the lawn in her negligee. You know, and I'll tell you something. I know that's not me lying out there on the lawn in my negligee, but when you're a child and your parents act a certain way, it might as well be you lying on the front lawn. Somehow you connect yourself with them. And I'm not blaming my mother for my alcoholism, okay? You know, I think you could be an alcoholic and come from a non-alcoholic home, but I can tell you this, if you come from an alcoholic home, it certainly has something to do with your self-esteem and it screws you up a little bit. So I can't help but believe, you know, that sort of experience, that sort of 10-step experience, which is really what that is, that's the 10-step. You know, not only did it help me, of course, a lot, and that's the way I live my life, you know, if I'm doing this thing. You know, sort of helped my son out. It did stuff for my son. Now, the interesting thing that happens, and I'll sort of wrap it up with this now, that I've noticed, it's funny, my concept and how I talk about these steps have changed significantly. And this gets back to what I was just first bringing up about that anxiety. Remember I said I felt a little anxiety? My whole life was a life of anxiety. You know, remember that the movie High Anxiety? My whole life was, that was my life, high anxiety. You know, all about, my God, driving in a car with me was nonstop me. And then this happened, then that happened. I mean, I had just story after story about my life and the horrors and the trepidations of my life. And what you would think my whole life was Bosnia or something like that. It was like horrible. And my life is pretty much boring and uneventful now. But except I hang around with guys who have very exciting lives. These guys' lives are very exciting. You know, and but in any event, what actually happens with this 10th step, and they talk about it in the big book, where they talk about restraint of tongue. You know, after you've apologized a lot, after you've gone up to tellers and banks and saying I was wrong a lot, and screwed up your courage and done that a lot, and you know the way we are alcoholics, you know, it says, how do we change our perception? Through 100 forms of what is it? I don't have the 12 and 12 here. The final crushing. How does our perception play? 100 forms of humiliation. Thank you. And the final crushing of our self-sufficiency and suffering is part of it. After you've suffered and you've been humiliated hundreds and hundreds of times over a period of 10 or 15 years, slowly but surely, you get to the point, trust me, where a light goes on and it says something like this. You know, if I don't say anything, I know I should say something. But if I don't say anything, there's a good chance I won't have to apologize for anything. You say things like, it's just, you know I should make this phone call to this rotten son of a bitch and tell him what I think. But here's what I'm thinking. If I don't pick up this phone and make this phone call, there's a possibility I might not screw up my day and have to apologize for something later. So what you do is you find, over a period of time, that you're less and less involved in doing the 10th step. Not because you get perfect, or, you know, like I'm growing wings, but you find that during the first 10 or 15 years, you got all sorts of examples of the 10th step. You know what I mean? I screwed up here and I apologize. But what happens is later on, you find that somehow, sort of magically, instead of figuring out how to try to get out of the potholes you dug for yourself, you figure out where the potholes are and how not to fall in them. So you screw up less and less. You hurt less and less people. You open your mouth up less and less. You react less and less. In other words, what happens is, surprisingly enough, where it used to be where I have a strong feeling and I have to say something, I couldn't help myself, I have to say something. What the strong feeling invokes is, all of a sudden the idea in your mind, it pops up, don't say anything. Strong feeling, shut up. All of a sudden it becomes clear that the stronger you feel about something, the more you have to shut the hell up. I can't explain that. That is so non-alcoholic. That is so beyond, like if I was to tell a newcomer, well, this is what you do. When you feel really strong about something, shut up. They'd say, I'm out of here, man. And forget it. This ain't, I ain't going to be able to do this deal. You know what I mean? I gotta talk. I got to say something. You got to listen to me. I got to shut up. I got to read. I mean, whoever invented burning, I know they're going to do it here again. You're going to do it here again. My sponsor used to say, Joe Stein says, whoever invented this burning desire crap. I mean, listen, I don't want anybody to drink. But after an A meeting, the last thing I want to hear is somebody with a burning desire. I mean, I'm feeling good. Everything's going out, you know. And somebody says, I got a desire. I want to kill my mother, you know what I mean, and drink. I don't want to. I mean, you have a burning desire, you should talk to your sponsor or something. Or burn outside or something like that. Smolder in the weeds. Or do a four-step or something. You know? Or if you have a burning desire, say it before. Announce that before the meeting so we can all laugh at you and talk about you during the meeting. Lots of to talk about. That could be like the subject of a meeting. But not after the meeting's over. You know, you hear burning desire after the meeting, you got to run to another meeting just to get rid of the desire, the burning desire. The smoke's all over you, you know what I mean? I mean, God. I don't know. But anyway. So, you know, I don't know whether that's the 10th step or not. It's something we brought. Hey, listen. Who knows what that is? We burned an hour, you know what I mean? You know what the heck? God bless you.